Election week continues, and today I sit down with Margaret Hoover and Kai Wright to talk about what this election tells us about our country. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, November 5th, we're watching vote counts in myriad states right along with you.
This vote is telling us our country is ignoring the fragility of our election process.
Today on the show, how Michigan went blue again.
It was really all about turnout, turnout, turnout. It's historically accurate that here in Michigan, when more voters turn out, Democrats win.
And Joe Biden takes Wisconsin, but it was a lot tighter than folks expected.
There are a lot of people who didn't want to answer polls, don't want to talk to pollsters. Pollsters are going to have to find ways to reach these people.
Votes are still being counted across the country, and Americans are waiting for a final decision on who the next president of the United States will be. So today we're looking at three battleground states, and we start in Wisconsin, where the votes have already been tallied and the state has turned blue for 2020, granting its 10 electoral votes to Democratic candidate Joe Biden. Back in 2016, Donald Trump won Wisconsin by a narrow margin over Hillary Clinton. But this year, following the news of Biden's apparent win, President Trump's campaign immediately said it would call for a recount. Meanwhile, Wisconsin is also at an all-time high for coronavirus cases in the state, with 5,000 new cases coming in on Wednesday alone. I've got two Wisconsin reporters on the line to talk about this. Rob Mentzer is a rural communities reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and Latoya Dennis is a news reporter at WUWM in Milwaukee. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So, Latoya, we're hearing that the Trump campaign wants a recount. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so basically the Trump campaign has said that they will ask for a recount. That cannot be formally done until all of the ballots have been actually submitted. I mean, they've been submitted, they've been counted, but there's another process that they have to go through in which they're turned over to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and that needs to happen by November 17th. So once that happens, the Trump campaign can officially ask for a recount, and then that recount will have to be done within 13 days of that formal ask.
And Latoya, just to give everyone a sense of where we are, I mean, the Associated Press and other news outlets have called Wisconsin for Joe Biden, but are there any other ballots still being counted right now?
You know, there are. There are about 300 missing ballots, and I say missing just because there was a clerk who got sick in a very small town on election day and went home. Well, they haven't been able to find that clerk in order to get those ballots, and so those ballots are still outstanding. But it's only about 300, which really wouldn't impact this either way.
That's what I was going to ask, Rob. I want to bring you in here because we heard former governor, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, say that it was unlikely that Trump would be able to close the gap, even with a recount. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, was that a surprise from Scott Walker, who's been a supporter of the president?
Yes, Scott Walker and some other Republicans have made the same observation. And the fact is that there is recent history of recounts in Wisconsin. There was a recount following the 2016 election initiated by the Jill Stein campaign, the third party campaign. And, you know, look, there can be like technical problems with vote counting and a recount. It's not necessarily bad to do a recount. There can be changes, but they in 2016, for example, it was in the neighborhood of 1500 votes. There's just no precedent for, you know, a change of ballots when there's a margin over 20,000 votes. So I think that's why Republicans have sort of said like realistically, a recount is not likely to change Wisconsin's outcome.
Let's talk a little bit about the messaging here from the Biden campaign specifically, Rob. How or did Joe Biden connect with voters in rural parts of the state outside of the urban centers?
Well, there are a couple big stories out of Wisconsin, but one of them is that President Trump's rural base really, really showed up on Tuesday and in voting. The counties that Trump won in 2016 in rural areas, he won again by the same like large margins, 20 points, 30 points, and improved those margins in a lot of places. There was a there were efforts by the Biden campaign to target rural areas and to reach out to rural voters and using different, you know, sorts of targeting and certainly messaging about Wisconsin's dairy farms and other issues of interest in rural areas. And they just didn't gain much ground. Where now, in the end, they gained a lot of ground in Dane County and Madison, Wisconsin. They held very strong margins in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. But in the rural areas, they did not gain ground. And that's why it ended up being such a surprisingly close finish in Wisconsin.
We've seen that playing out in a lot of states, actually, how close this race was. LaToya, tell us a little bit about that, about Biden's strategy in Milwaukee. And was that a, it seems like, based on what Rob is saying, that was really the thing that helped push Biden over the edge, really?
Definitely. Milwaukee and Dane County, which includes Madison, Wisconsin. So I have to say that Biden did much better here than Hillary Clinton did 4 years ago. And he absolutely had to. He had to turn out the vote in Milwaukee, and he had to turn out the vote in the Madison area. And so in doing that, he was able to gain enough votes to actually push him over the edge here, because he needed these Democratic strongholds. There was some concern because some of the problem in 2016 was that Hillary Clinton didn't visit here after the primary. Biden did come, but it was only once after in the last month of the election, which was the Friday before Election Day. And so there was some concern about his ground game here and whether enough was done, but they got the vote.
Rob, were there any, I mean, we know that exit polls are not, they're not written in stone and they're largely imperfect, but we are looking at them right now. Were there any themes that stood out to you, Rob, in terms of the exit polling so far? I mean, did Trump win the white woman suburban vote, for example?
Sure. You see, in exit polls, I remember being surprised by the percent of people in exit polls who were saying that the economy was the most important to them, and relatively lower numbers saying that the coronavirus was a top priority. And that may be an indicator of how the election day vote itself, people who voted on the day of in person, may have been more likely to be Trump voters. I think that's probably a fairly coherent story. Overall, there was a big polling miss in Wisconsin prior to the election. There, the polling averages showed Biden with a very comfortable lead, and Biden won Wisconsin, but it was not a very comfortable lead. And so I think that there are a lot of people who didn't want to answer polls, don't want to talk to pollsters, they say are low trust people. And I do think that there's a problem there, and that if we're going to sort of look at these things, pollsters are going to have to find ways to reach these people.
That's been a big theme also that's come up as we analyze what's happened with this election, the reliability or lack thereof on polling. LaToya, I do want to, talk also about the fact that Wisconsin has a lot of different types of reputations, but one of them is that it's one of the worst places for Black Americans to live in this country on multiple social indicators. And I'm wondering whether or not Black voters came out in favor of Joe Biden. And if so, did he have a message for Black voters in the state?
Black voters definitely turned out for Joe Biden this time around. And you see that in the fact that he so handedly won the city of Milwaukee, which is a majority Black, definitely majority minority city. And I'm not sure that he had a very strong message for Black voters. I mean, he did, it's been the same when it comes to the Democratic line in general. So I don't know that there was anything that he did in talking to voters here that particularly stood out to them and them saying, yeah, we believe he's the guy for us. It seemed more so it was as though it was a vote against Trump than for Biden.
Now, that is interesting because, as we mentioned, Black residents of the state of Wisconsin, particularly Black men, have the experiences there in terms of high rates of incarceration, poverty, ability to get a mortgage, housing discrimination. I mean, it is really one of the worst states to be Black in this country. And so are Black voters expecting more from Joe Biden Even if you, as you say, they voted for him without many promises, but what is their expectation?
I think they're hopeful, right? They're hopeful that he'll look at police reform and that their questions and their concerns and that what they've just been asking for so long will be addressed.
Rob, I'm wondering, you know, of course, we've got all of this is happening in the shadow of a coronavirus pandemic, which has been very politicized, including in the state of Wisconsin, which has gone back and forth on whether or not there should be a mask mandate or not. Are you hearing from voters, or did you hear from voters, that that had anything to do with how they voted?
The state of the pandemic in Wisconsin is just the water that we swim in recent weeks. It is the worst it has been. You know, hospitalizations are at their all-time highs, and it's been bad for enough weeks that deaths are really high. There, you know, where I live in central Wisconsin, everyone knows people who are affected by COVID-19. So, there's no way to have an election without that being in people's minds. On the other hand, on election day and sort of this week, there's not a lot of evidence that that people really change their voting behavior, change their sort of partisan identity as a response to the pandemic. I mean, this result, it looks a lot like 2016's result, or even like 2018's gubernatorial election in Wisconsin, where there's these incredibly tight margins, and it's sort of rural areas versus cities and suburbs. COVID-19 does not seem to have upended that same electoral dynamic that we saw in these previous elections.
It's very surprising, Rob. I think so many people are scratching their heads that a public health crisis has become a political issue, quite frankly. It's very surprising that in a state where there's so many people who have been affected, I mean, I keep having flashbacks to when New York City was the center of it. It's a terrifying experience, and it's one that has forever changed me, and I'm sure a lot of other New Yorkers. So one would hope that people understand that it's not political, that it's science, but, you know, we can only hope for the best. LaToya, before we wrap here, how are people in Milwaukee reacting to the news that Joe Biden has potentially won the state?
You know, it's interesting. Before you asked me a question about Joe Biden's promises for Black people, right? What was his message to Black people? And I can say that I've been checking social media this morning, and some of the people I've been checking are Black community activists. And basically, they're saying, Democrats, we saved you here once again. Put some money behind where your talk is now, right? They're saying, we came out for you. Don't forget about us now. And outside of that, there's excitement. Of course, everyone knows that there will be a recount, but there's excitement and people are ready to move ahead.
Rob Mentzer is a rural communities reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and LaToya Dennis is a news reporter with WUWM in Milwaukee. Thanks again to you both, and we'll be sure to check back.
Thank you.
Let's take a look now in Georgia, where ballots are still being counted and the race is still too close to be called. But the gap between President Trump and Joe Biden has narrowed, and a federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit filed by the president's team that challenged the vote counting process. There's also two Senate races in the state to watch. The race between Democrat John Ossoff and incumbent David Perdue is still being tallied, and Democrat Raphael Warnock and incumbent Kelly Loeffler are themselves headed to a runoff. Joining us again is Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, welcome back.
Thank you.
So the margins have become even more razor thin between Biden and Trump. How many ballots are there remaining to count?
We're hearing that there are about 50,000 ballots. You know, the number's been fluctuating because Georgia's 159 counties all are doing their own ballot counting. So to have one universal number, you know, it's been fluctuating, but we think about 50,000 ballots left to be counted.
And is there a deadline for, we know we've been seeing regular updates from Georgia election officials to the press, but is there a deadline to have those ballots counted?
Well, I mean, there is a certification deadline that's roughly 2 weeks from Election Day. But state officials are hoping that ballots could, they could finalize counting by the end of the day on Thursday. That's their hope.
We've also gotten word of a decision by a Georgia judge around a Trump campaign lawsuit in the state. What happened there? The judge apparently dismissed this lawsuit.
Yes. So the lawsuit was very limited. Down in Savannah, which is Chatham County, Georgia, there was a Republican poll watcher. And initially what the Trump campaign and the Republican Party alleged is that the poll watcher saw some of the vote counters allowing ballots that came in after the deadline to be counted. In Georgia, your ballot must be received by the time polls close, which is 7 p.m. on Tuesday. But when it got before a judge, the poll watcher said they didn't actually have any evidence of wrongdoing. It was more of a suspicion. And so that's why that case was dismissed. All along, the Chatham County election official said, you know, they are mistaken. We've done nothing wrong. And even at the core, the complaint was about roughly 50 ballots. So relatively very, very small in the relative scope of things.
Are there any additional legal challenges that you're watching right now in the state? Or I'm sure both sides are pretty much lawyered up right now.
Both sides are lawyered up. The Biden campaign has hired some lawyers. Of course, we know the Republican Party and the Trump campaign have lawyers. But at this point, there are no other lawsuits that we know of, but particularly if Biden pulls ahead right now, he's about 15,000 votes down, again, with about 50,000 votes to be counted. So we do expect additional legal challenges.
Tia, Stacey Abrams was a big reason for the increased turnout this year. Isn't that right?
I mean, I think Abrams gets credit. You know, Democrats across the state and then therefore Democrats from across the country really zeroed in on Georgia when it became clear that the state could flip blue and that Biden had a chance of winning the state and therefore winning its electoral college votes. Stacey Abrams created a blueprint in 2018 when she ran for governor of how Democrats can compete statewide and look to expand the coalition beyond kind of Atlanta. And so in addition to that, of course, we know she created various organizations that are on the ground working on turnout, working on voter protection to ensure that folks have access to the ballot and then all ballots are counted. So, of course, she's getting a lot of credit, well deserved.
There are, of course, two Senate seats that are up for grabs in Georgia. The Democrats nationally have not yet taken over the Senate. One of these races could essentially tip the balance there. I mean, we have the Senate race between Democrat Reverend Raphael Warnock and Senator Kelly Loeffler. Warnock was leading in the polls. What happens now?
Well, that was a special election because Loeffler fulfilled the seat of Johnny Isaacson, who retired early. So now there's a special election for the remaining 2 years of his term. There were 21 candidates. So, yes, Warnock was in the lead because Democratic support kind of coalesced around him. But Loeffler finished second, headed to the runoff against Warnock. But third place was U.S. Representative Doug Collins, another Republican. So together, and Collins has already endorsed Loeffler. Together, they achieved about 46% of the vote. So that's one race. And again, that's going to a runoff, which we knew would happen with 21 candidates. It would be hard for any one candidate to get to the 50% to avoid a runoff. But now in the other U.S. Senate race, which is for David Perdue's seat, he was seeking another 6-year term in office. Right now, he has fallen below the 50% threshold as well. He is leading Democrat John Ossoff, but if he does not make 50%, there is a third party libertarian candidate that's polling at about, that got about 2% of the vote. And so it looks like Ossoff and Perdue could also be headed to a runoff.
What's the mood on the ground there, Tia, today, as we've seen in other cities across the country, particularly in Detroit and in Maricopa County in Arizona, that there were folks who were protesting, wanting ballots to stop being counted. A lot of those were Trump supporters. Are we seeing similar reactions on the ground in Georgia?
So on the ground, no. And I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, Georgia is run by Republicans, and those Republican elected officials are saying, we are counting every vote. All we're doing is making sure the process plays out fairly. So it's hard to protest when the Secretary of State is a Republican who's saying, hey, we're doing everything right. It's just taking some time. Also, again, every Georgia county, there are 159 counties, are handling their own counting. And so there isn't kind of one place to zero in on. Now, there have been a couple of Republican elected officials who have joined President Trump in falsely accusing Democrats of trying to steal the election. Congresswoman-elect Marjorie Taylor Greene, Congressman Jody Heiss. But again, they have been mainly on social media, peddling some of the misinformation that President Trump has spread. And those things have been false, but they have not led thus far to any on-the-ground protests.
Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, the Associated Press declared Joe Biden the winner in Michigan, granting the Democratic frontrunner an additional 16 electoral votes. But that didn't stop a group of protesters, many of them white Trump supporters, from gathering outside of a polling place in Detroit and banging on doors and windows to stop votes from being counted. The Trump campaign filed a lawsuit to halt the absentee vote counting process, claiming that members of the campaign didn't have, quote, meaningful access to observe the ballot counting. But it's unclear at the moment how consequential that lawsuit will be in Michigan's final results. Joining me now to discuss where things are in Michigan is Zoe Clark, program director for Michigan Radio and co-host of the show It's Just Politics. Zoe, thanks for being with me.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
How did Biden's campaign approach campaigning in Michigan compared to, say, Hillary Clinton in 2016?
Yeah, it was really all about turnout, turnout, turnout. It's historically accurate that here in Michigan, when more voters turn out, Democrats win. That was part of the issue with Hillary Clinton in 2016. As I've said often before, it's not so much that Donald Trump won Michigan in 2016, but Hillary Clinton lost Michigan 4 years ago. And so Biden was able to bring back some of that Barack Obama coalition that won the state in 2008 and in 2012.
It isn't lost on me that the protesters who surrounded the polling place last night in Detroit were largely white. Detroit is a largely black city. What was black voter turnout like this year?
Higher than it was 4 years ago. And that is an indication of just how important Wayne County, the county in which Detroit is, was for Biden. What happened 4 years ago is that some 40,000 did not turn out in that area. And so what we saw was voter turnout at some historic levels. We've heard from the city that they're estimating that was between 53% and 55% turnout, which would be, close to what President Obama got in 08. And so comparatively, these sort of outstate rural voters who turned up in 2016, what we're still digging into is it looks like, you know, the same number of Trump supporters stepped up again this year. It's just that more folks who were voting for Biden came out than they had 4 years ago.
It's one of the most interesting things about this election is that people have been mobilized on both sides of the political divide here to come out and vote. We mentioned that the Trump campaign has filed a lawsuit to halt the absentee ballot counting process, and there are also protests from Trump supporters about stopping the count. Where do those stand?
Right. So a lawsuit had been filed and has been filed in the Court of Claims here in Michigan. It's likely that a judge is going to try to, you know, get through this case as soon as possible. So we don't expect a lot of waiting. Look, the Secretary of State of Michigan came out yesterday and said this was a frivolous lawsuit. I can tell you that Michigan Radio had folks at TCF Center in Detroit. I'm going to quote our Michigan radio reporter, Justin Dwyer, who's in Grand Rapids. That's on the west side of the state. And he said, I was literally just in a room in Michigan where more than 59,000 absentee ballots are being tabulated. He says there are Republican challengers in the room, fully active in the process. The county clerk overseeing it all is a Republican who said in 2018 she supports Trump's policies.
So I think in the end, unless there is some sort of evidence or actual something that we can see, I haven't seen any instances of voter fraud or anything like that in the state over the past 48 hours.
Zoe, want to also get a sense of what's playing out when it comes to protesters and people who are looking to stop the count. What's the mood been on the ground?
There were a group of folks who, it appears, Republicans in Michigan had called out to go to the TCF Center. It appeared that maybe they got some inaccurate information that Republicans were not being let into the TCF Center. Again, that is not accurate. There were reporters there counting how many folks, whether it be poll watchers or challengers, were there. But, you know, misinformation is just that. And so some folks were there. And what was happening is the security outside of TCF Center were not letting folks in because of COVID restrictions, right? As we are still in the middle of this historic pandemic, there were only so many people that were allowed in this very large room. And I mean, there were hundreds of people in this room already. And so these folks weren't allowed in. And one of the issues that sort of sparked some of these, you know, so-called demonstrations was that there were members of the media who were being let in to allow to watch and document what was going on. So some of these Republican protesters were saying, you know, hey, look, you know, talk to me about the number of restrictions and folks that are in there because you just let, you know, them in, but you won't let us in. There was some talk, well, there was a certain number of media that they were already accounting for that was allowed. And so it turned into a situation, as we heard, that, you know, folks were chanting, some pounding on the walls. But overall, the police security was able to tamp things down. Did it get heated? Yes, but it did not get to a point where the demonstrations got violent. But there was definitely, you know, yelling by Republicans. But overall, things went off without a hitch.
Democrats were not able to flip the state legislature in Michigan this year. How is it that they fell short, despite the fact that Biden has had success in that state?
Yeah, I mean, I push back about the falling short. I mean, I think what it was is that across the country, there were some expectations because of some polls. And I'm sure we'll all be discussing this yet again for the next 4 years. This sort of showed there was going to be this blue wave, right? This sort of historic Biden sweep that down ballot would help Democrats. And, you know, folks were saying, oh, if Biden gets, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 points extra here in Michigan, that'll help down ballot. It doesn't appear that was the case. It looks like it's going to end up being closer to 2 or 3 points. And so down ballot, it didn't do as much in state house races. But I want to note a lot of that here in Michigan has to do with the way that our both congressional and our state house and state senate maps are drawn. And interestingly enough, 2 years ago, voters approved basically an independent commission who will take up maps because folks in Michigan said, look, you know, maps are gerrymandered. We want change. So, you know, statewide, more Democrats voted for Biden, but lower down in the ticket, that did not appear to happen in the state house. So Michigan will go forward with a Democratic governor in Gretchen Whitmer and a Republican controlled House and Senate, both chambers, for the next 2 years.
There's also a very close Senate race in Michigan between the incumbent Democrat Gary Peters and John James. Were you surprised at how that race turned out to be so close?
No. In fact, one respect that the polls were accurate was that this was likely going to be a close race. Look, Gary Peters, he was a Democrat who has been considered sort of a moderate Democrat. This was his first re-election campaign. He won the first time 6 years ago. So we all knew it was going to be close because John James, who is sort of a Republican rising star, who was running against him, had run in Michigan in a U.S. Senate race against sitting Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow 2 years ago. So John James had really high name recognition for a candidate, right? Because folks knew him from 2 years ago. So, you know, there's also some question that I'll be interested in as we dig into the votes a little more. Were there ticket splitters, right? Were there folks who might be Republican who couldn't bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump, maybe even voted for Biden instead, but decided, well, I'm going to even out my ballot and vote for John James as you know, sort of sending a Republican to D.C. But in the end, Gary Peters did win. And a lot of that, again, has to do with the Democratic turnout here in Michigan.
Zoe Clark is the program director for Michigan Radio. Zoe, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
In Nevada, Joe Biden's lead in the election has widened, but election officials are still counting ballots and have not yet called the race. In the meantime, President Trump's campaign announced they would file a lawsuit challenging more than 10,000 votes, which they say were cast by people who do not live in Nevada. The campaign, of course, will be expected to prove those allegations. I'm joined now by James DeHaven, political reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So it's a fluctuating number, we know, but where does the vote count stand, and is there a deadline that the state is expected to meet?
Yes, November 16th is the hard deadline for the vote to actually be canvassed and completed. But effectively, they have a week to get out all of the unofficial results, and they're actually very close as it is. Here we are on day two or three or whatever. The lead right now for Biden is about 11,438 votes, so roughly 1%. It's still very tight, not likely to be called until at least this afternoon, very late, if at all.
And what are we, in terms of the split right now, a lot of the states, I should say, that we are talking to are really seeing a split between mail-in ballots and in-person voting. Is this all mail-in ballots that are still being tallied?
Yes, depending on how you define mail-in ballots. Apparently, officials have already taken care of the in-person voting on Election Day. But since all Nevadans got a mail-in ballot this cycle, a lot of them dropped them off on Election Day at a ballot drop-off location or at a polling location. So to whatever extent that counts as a mail-in, that's what they're still counting and that's what's outstanding.
The margins here are razor thin, and I'm wondering what that tells us about who turned out. Is there the same rural versus urban divide in Nevada that we're seeing in many of the other battleground states?
Yeah, and it's probably actually even slightly more pronounced. We basically have two urban population centers in Nevada, Reno, where I am, and then down in Las Vegas, which is in Clark County. And effectively, the way that Republicans have won here in the past is by turning out everybody else who doesn't live in those places. And it's a big state, so there's 15 other rural counties. But it doesn't look like Trump has turned out enough of them this time to overcome Biden's. He had like an 89,000, turnout lead down in Vegas coming out of early voting. So it's looking like Trump didn't quite get the rural voters that he needed to push him over the top.
The president says he's going to file a lawsuit challenging about 10,000 votes that have already been cast, alleging that the people who voted were not residents of the state of Nevada. What does that tell us right now? What do we know so far about that?
I think the primary thing it tells us is that the Trump camp is doing everything it can to not to stop the counting. I don't want to go that far, but to maybe delay it and make sure that all they're happy with all the procedures. They filed four or five lawsuits already, all of which were tossed very, very quickly. Judges here and elsewhere seem to have no interest in slowing down the vote count. So I think what this latest lawsuit tells us has more to do with politics than it does with the law.
Talk a little bit more about who turned out to the polls so far, with the understanding that a lot of this information is fluid. We've been talking a lot, particularly after seeing the results of Florida, a lot about the quote unquote Latino vote, or should I say more how Latinos are voting in this election. What did it look like in Nevada? Were there strong coalitions of Latino voters in Nevada?
Yes, there are very strong coalitions of Latino voters, especially in Las Vegas, where the Culinary Union holds a lot of power and basically drives the Democratic ground game down there. And I think the difference this time in Nevada is both sides really catered to the Latino vote. I haven't seen a lot of really good exit polls suggesting how much Trump may have shaved off from, you know, Biden's presumed lead among Latinos. But I would expect that he, did fairly well. Or at least better than in 2016. Like I said, his campaign worked hard to reach out to them. So they're 20% of the vote here. They're going to make a big difference. It's just a matter of how big, and I'm not sure we know that yet.
And when we say they, just because there's so much talk about the who this mythical Latino vote is in Nevada, we're talking mostly about Latinos of Mexican descent, right?
Correct.
So it's a mixed bag of different points of view. What about independent voters in Nevada? They seem to be an interesting coalition as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they are making up a fast-growing share of the electorate here and elsewhere. They have tended to lean towards Democrats in the past three presidential cycles. I haven't seen a lot of evidence to suggest that that's changed in 2020. But again, we're just not going to know that for sure for at least a couple more days and probably weeks.
What's the mood on the ground, James? Because we are seeing in the states that are still counting, there's been some, I don't want to say necessarily protests or unrest, but there have definitely been protests in certain cities around the country where votes are still being tallied. Is there any sense of that happening in Nevada?
No, we had one. I think the hashtag was Stop the Steal sort of rally last night down in Vegas. It dispersed after about a half hour. Things here really been actually, pleasantly surprising in terms of how quiet they've been. State and local election officials predicted from the outset that we wouldn't see the voter intimidation a lot of people were afraid of, and that is borne out. So I think everyone's pretty pleased with that development.
What happens next as we wait for a count? We're expected to have a final answer at some point, maybe today, maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, potentially. We think there's, maybe as many as 150 votes still outstanding in the state. So it really depends how quickly you can process those. Clark County can do 70,000 a day. Washoe, I think, can do 20 or 30. So it's really hard to put a firm end date on it. But I can tell you that the campaign or the local elections officials around here have made it very clear they're more interested in getting it done right than getting it done quick.
And how does this compare to, James, to 2016? I mean, were the margins as thin as they are now?
That's a good question. They certainly were in Washoe. I think Trump won Washoe by 1%. But I think Biden's actually underperforming Hillary Clinton and Clark right now. I think Hillary took Clark by 11 points or so, which is about where statewide Democratic candidates tend to land there. I think Biden's at 8 right now. So he's got a little bit of ground to make up. If he makes it up, that could be a quick call, though.
James DeHaven is political reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal. James, thanks so much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, thank you.
And while we all wait to learn the final results of the 2020 presidential election, there's already a lot of conversation about what the results so far can tell us about who we are as a country. Here's what you had to say.
This is Noah from Wilsonville, Oregon. This entire election cycle has taught me that fear has become too much a part of our politics. We have started voting out of fear for what the other person or party will do if elected, not out of hopes for what the person we're voting for will achieve. This makes me sad as an American.
This is Angela from Charlotte, North Carolina. What this election tells me is that we are yet to deal with the remnants of slavery. The Electoral College is a remnant of the 3/5 rule that has changed and continued to have an aftertaste in our electoral process and the way people are treated. It's time to change.
My name is Mark Yerkew. I live in Westport, Connecticut, and this election made me realize half the people that I run past every day think very differently than me.
To talk through all of this and more, I'm joined now by Kai Wright, the host of WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. Kai, thanks for being with us.
Hey there.
Also with us is Margaret Hoover, the host of PBS's Firing Line with Margaret Hoover. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's dive right in, folks. President Trump, when he won in 2016, it was caught a lot of folks by surprise. But this year, I feel like it's even more of a surprise for some Americans who are stunned that after COVID-19, 8 million people being pushed into poverty, historically low approval ratings, family separation, that the president is still close to winning, that he came quite close in this. What does this tell us about our country? Kai, let's start with you.
Well, I guess first off, I think it's really interesting to think about the emotional response to this, because as we stand, Joe Biden is on path to quite a resounding victory, actually. You know, if as the trends are headed, if he manages to win in both Arizona and Georgia, he will have flipped two Republican states and won back at least already two Democratic states. Which is a significant victory, you know, in terms of, and has more, a higher number of people in the popular vote voted for him than ever in history of the presidency. So on one hand, there's that. And yet, there, as you point out, there is this widespread frustration that there were so many people who were Republicans and who had supported Donald Trump in the past that continue to support him. And I think, you know, it's just, it's interesting to me that people wanted something from this election that I don't think the election could ever provide, which was this repudiation of the idea of Donald Trump. I don't know that the election was ever set up for that.
That's an interesting point, because I think you're right. I think a lot of people were looking for that, obviously, if they were Democrats in particular. But Margaret, what are your thoughts on this? What does this tell us so far about our country?
Well, I would like to just posit that, you know, Kai, you started, and I agree with you, by suggesting how shocked we are that the, you know, and many people are, that there hasn't been a fundamental repudiation of Donald Trump. But I will say there is equal shock amongst the people who Donald Trump turned out for this election that he may be losing, because they believed so deeply in their heart of hearts that he was winning, as the president did, and that he would win and would be vindicated and win a second term. So I think a lot of what this election tells us is how deeply polarized the country is. There are deeply red states and deeply blue states and deep blue pockets within those states. You know, even look at Arizona. I mean, there are blue counties in Arizona and there are red counties in Arizona. Even within the context of that state, people cannot believe that the other guy won. And I think what we've recognized is how sick our politics is and how sick our country is from this polarization.
But I think that's definitely another part of it, right? There are lots of folks who are just wanting to put their head in the sand and just wait till this whole thing blows over. You know, there were some voters who said that they might have been voting with their own interests first, and there are others who said they might have been voting for communities other than their own, right? There might have been people who were taking to the polls to vote for people who are undocumented and can't vote, for example. Was there a greater sense, Kai, that you think that people voted for issues outside of themselves, or was this really driven, you think, by self-interest?
I think that we have to be able to think about it in a more granular way on some level. So, for instance, like when you say that, I think about, I saw one stat that in Florida, for instance, more people voted for the to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour than for either Joe Biden or Donald Trump, implying that there was, in fact, unity on that mm-hmm. question. So there are, and we look at some of these initiatives around the decriminalization or legalization of marijuana. There are particular specific issues that I think that a wide swath of Americans agree upon. But when asked to choose, what camp do you sit in this, I think, core culture war that has been mapped over as according to partisan presidential politics has become sort of a proxy for these core culture wars around race and gender and identities. For those, yeah, it's stark. But I also want to say, you know, when we think about this divide, we shouldn't lose track of, you know, you were talking about Michigan earlier in the show. And, you know, something that you guys talked about there is we also have to remember how perverse the districts are in terms of gerrymandering in these states. And so the way that these boundaries have been drawn over the last 10 years, they're drawn to make sure that there is not a lot of variation between those counties. You might be able to, so on a high turnout election, you might see something where you have huge numbers of Democrats or Republicans win something statewide. But in terms of change from just jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the county, they've been drawn for the purpose of them not changing.
Margaret, there's been a lot of talk about violence against people of color, police brutality, white privilege, white supremacy. Has any of that, do you think, influenced white voters, white American voters this time around?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would maybe quibble a little bit with the characterization that voting for the good of others is not voting in your own interest, right? I mean, I think I vote in my own interest all the time, but I think part of my own interest is taking care of other people. So I think that people can, I don't think there's anything wrong with voting in your own interest. I think, you know, we have a lot of people, to your point, Tanzina, that I think look at suburban women, right? Suburban women are, of course, voting for their own interests. They're voting for their own families. They're voting for their own communities. But they repudiated Donald Trump because of the specifically the issues that you suggested, these issues, and Kai, that you spoke about, of racial reconciliation that we're still grappling with in our country, of minimum wage, of criminal justice reform. I mean, these aren't issues that necessarily impact, you know, working moms in the suburbs of this country, but they do, it does impact them, maybe not directly, but it impacts them because they care about these issues. So I think you can vote in your own interest, but if your own interest cares and is empathetic for about others and about the good of our country.
Margaret, how do you explain the fact that President Trump has still appealed to so many voters? Because I think your point at the very top of the conversation was really accurate. I mean, we are living in such a deeply divided country right now. There is an appeal that this president has that I think half of the country just doesn't understand.
Look, we are a big country. And a lot of us, I think part of it, Tanzina, if you recall, remember when Donald Trump won, and there was a real effort on behalf of many people, liberal elites in particular, to go out into the country and try to figure out how they had been so blindsided.
You're talking about the diner interviews.
Yes. Who are these people who elected Donald Trump, right? And who are the ones that voted for Barack Obama twice and then voted for Donald Trump? You know, how did this happen? And, you know, I think it's incumbent on all of us to get outside of our bubbles and try to understand. But I think to answer your question, And this is, there are various levels of this. I mean, there are a lot of people, having seen Donald Trump for 4 years, that simply were not bothered by his behavior in the debates, his handling of the coronavirus, his, you know, his speaking and giving real sunlight to some of the worst and ugliest traditions in American history. I'm looking at neo-Nazis and Proud Boys. That simply weren't bothered by that. And I think there does need to be a bit of analysis done on sort of that there is an authoritarian trend that we see not just in Donald Trump, but in leaders around the world. You're seeing it in Europe. You're seeing it in Latin America. And why is there an interest and an affinity for authoritarian leaders in this time globally? And I think we should look at that, because there are a lot of Americans that weren't turned off by the things that you and Kai and I have been turned off by.
Well, and I think that a lot of folks are going to call it and say what it is. They're going to say it's plain racism. It's the fact that largely Trump supporters are largely white, rural, and have come out in droves to support him because they don't just not want to repudiate it, but that they actually like some of this messaging. Kai, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, because that feels like it's something that in particular, not only does the GOP have to figure out where it goes from here, regardless of whether the president wins or not, but I think the Democrats also have to figure out how they weren't able to get a big, quote unquote, blue wave. But let's take the first part of that.
And beyond Republicans and Democrats, we as a country have to reckon with this. I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think there was this notion for some people that, you know, well, if people just had their blinders removed, if they could see what I could see about Donald Trump, they would change their mind. My, you know, estranged brother or cousin or whoever, who I can't believe would support this man. People have not been able to say, well, maybe it's about that people actually agree with him. They actually see this. It's not like you're smarter than that person over there and you can see it and they can't. No, people have listened to Donald Trump and said, I agree with this. I believe in this. And that, and a significant part of that, we have to acknowledge, is racism and sexism, that there are openly racist and sexist and xenophobic things about Donald Trump's appeal, and that there are significant parts of explicitly white America that supports those ideas. And that shouldn't come as a surprise, because we have hundreds of years of this history that we've never dealt with. So there's a way in which, you know, just these past 4 years and now again in this election, a broad swath of Americans have been confronted with the reality that there is, in fact, a very real strain of anti-black and anti-brown and anti-woman sentiment in this country, and it's not going to go away because the coronavirus came along and is going and would change the political map.
It's not going to go away, you know, regardless politics. Of who becomes president. And I want to, I mean, that's something that we're going to have to deal with the effects of this for quite some time. I want to go back to one of the calls we heard at the beginning of the segment, because I think this might be a big reason for a lot of what we're seeing on both sides of the political divide. The idea that people are voting because of what they're fearful of, not because of what they're hopeful of. Margaret, do you agree?
I can only speak for myself. I speak for what I vote, and I, you know, I organize my life and my politics around what I'm hopeful for. Fear is a factor, though. I do think it is, and I think, Kai, all the things you said are right, but I think this also fits within a larger global trend of economic uncertainty and this rise of authoritarian instincts and impulses that you see around the world. And I think we would be remiss to not put the American experience within a larger context, a global context of economic uncertainty, automation, all the technological advances that are happening and displacing people that draw on the worst, the nativist instincts, the racist instincts and traditions, the worst instincts of, you know, I think human nature. Times of uncertainty and tumult and huge change bring us, I think, not to the best version of ourselves.
So, Kai, I mean, one of the things that this is going to, you know, whatever the outcome is really going to be an analysis, I think, by both parties are going to have to do about their future and where they go from here. And if Biden is able to pull off a win, you know, how do you think the future of the Democratic Party will look after that? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we still have two white old men who are running for president.
I mean, there are huge questions about the Democratic Party moving forward and the Republican Party moving forward. They both have a very rocky road ahead of them, you know, and for the Democrats, a couple of things are clear. One, you know, Joe Biden's theory, and I have to say, I think he has run an incredible campaign, which I would not have expected. Joe Biden's theory, though, was that he was going to be able to hold and turn out the Democratic base of Black people primarily and people of color in cities and young people. And, you know, and he would then be able to bring in a rush of white people, of white Republicans, of white conservatives who have not been in the Democratic Party since 1964, you know, and I think that they thought they would be the people to sort of change that, to end the Southern strategy, as it were. And that has not happened. Whatever happens in this election, that did not happen. So the question then is, how does this pretty moderate leader, you know, who sort of thinks about Democratic politics in mid-20th century terms, lead a party that is, despite turning out for him, is far left of him, I think, and far more diverse than him, and far younger than him, and far more interested in fundamental reforms than him. I think that's going to be an interesting question.
I wonder if it even gives. I think a lot of voters, particularly voters of color, are particularly Black voters and Black women, if we're going to get very granular, they are a huge reason for why Joe Biden even got the votes that he got. And there is a real sense. First of all, there's a couple things happening. I think that voters of color feel, particularly Black women voters, feel like the Democratic Party needs to do more. For them, we heard earlier in our report in Wisconsin, I was asking our reporter on the ground there about what message Joe Biden had for Black residents of the state. It's one of the worst states to be Black in this country. And she said, you know, Biden really didn't have a message for Black voters. And so that struck me as odd and a missed opportunity.
Well, you know, it is. But it's also, I think, what's an unnamed dynamic for the party is that we are increasingly in a place where it's not about Black voters and Black women saying what that party over there is doing for me. We're in a place where those voters and activists are taking over the party, right? And so we are quickly to the point where there is going where there's enough power and leadership amongst Black constituencies to be in charge of the party. And so that's, you know, that's the lesson of Georgia, quite frankly. You know, if you look at a state like Georgia that, you know, we don't know, but it looks at this point, at minimum, it is a purple state, and it may well be a Democratic state by the end of this election. You know, that is a place where for the, you know, roughly a decade, Stacey Abrams as a Black woman and the constituents she has built have been filling the void where the Democratic Party was not, you know, where a corporate Democratic Party was not investing in a place like Georgia. They have said, well, we're going to invest in ourselves. And they built, and there has been significant conflict between Stacey Abrams and her world and the party prior to now. You know, that she wasn't always the darling of the party. There was a while in which the National Party and her did not get on.
Until she was able to deliver votes, or at least her strategy was able to deliver votes.
That's right. Until she started to change the state. You know, but the point is that that's a lesson in that it wasn't about waiting for the party to show up. It was about, oh, okay, well, we're going to build a party we want here. I think you're seeing the same thing in Texas with a more multiracial coalition, you know, of both Latino and Black voters and activists who have said, well, we're just going to change it then. We're going to change it ourselves. And I think that is the tension that is going to be the future of the party. But also might be the salvation of the party, because those are voters in places that break up this sort of this geographic, you know, basically I call it the Confederacy, but this solid block of Republican votes across the South and the Sun Belt for most of my lifetime, that has been minority rule in those places. And now there are activists both inside and outside of the Democratic Party that are dedicated to changing that. And that's going to ultimately change national politics.
I want to thank Margaret Hoover, the host of PBS's Firing Line with Margaret Hoover, and Kai Wright, the host of WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's all for me this week. Amy Walter and the politics team are with you this weekend. It's been a long and interesting week, but we're going to get through it, and we're glad you're with us. The crew that makes this show worked a ton this week and really deserves a great big shout out from everyone. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Amber Hall and Patricia Jacob are our politics team. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer and board operator. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Our producer crew is led by Alexandra Boti and includes Meg Dalton, Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. David Gable is our executive assistant. Don't forget, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.